Hello, folks. Welcome to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you by our listener-supported community radio station, WFT, broadcasting from downtown Champaign, Illinois at 90.1 FM and at WFT.org, live worldwide. And the views and opinions expressed here are those of speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the station manager, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now, here's Gus with some underwriting announcements.
This hour program is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month at 9:30 a.m. at Channing Murray Foundation, 1209 West Oregon, Urbana. For more information, visit www.centralillinoisjobswithjustice.org. Programming on the World Labor Hours is supported in part by listeners of WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour. The World Labor Hour is supported in part by listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. The Graduate Employees Organization Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice, both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio.
Okay, real quick, I want to get some public service announcements out here. We got kind of a full show today, and I just want to mention that you can tune in this Saturday and every Saturday at 2 p.m. for None Another Sports Show with host fellow worker Neil Parthen, who, by the way, Gus Wood is going to be on the show today. So you can tune in for that, and that's at WRFU 104.5 FM and also online at WRFU.org. And also this Sunday and every Sunday, tune in from 4 to 5 p.m. for Labor's World View TV at Comcast Channel 6 or live on the Internet at UrbanaPublicTelevision.org. Okay, well, we're going to be having a caller call in at 11:30. It's Professor, Economics Professor Gerald Friedman, who's done extensive studies of what it would involve to have a single-payer Medicare for all healthcare system in the United States. One of the reasons we wanted to have him call in was because there was a Wall Street Journal article recently that was used by Hillary Clinton to attack Bernie Sanders for his proposal for a single-payer healthcare system. And both Hillary Clinton's attack, which is based on the Wall Street Journal article, was a total distortion of Professor Friedman's study. So we want him to call in and set the record straight on that. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, there's been a lot going on, and we'll start off with Gus. What's going on?
I'll save the I have a kind of a wrap up and what we're looking forward to in 2016 in terms of the economic conditions of the masses of people, both in the United States and global. I'll save that for after the caller because I think it's a really good wrap up for the show. So we'll talk about another police officer escaping indictment for shooting an unarmed man in Colorado. So this latest exoneration for the police shooting of unarmed civilians came on Wednesday, when Aurora, Colorado police officer Paul Geroth escaped charges for the March 6th killing of 37-year-old Nashilas Vinson. The killing led to protests against police brutality throughout the Denver area, and Vinson was shot and killed on March 6th while fleeing from Aurora Police Department SWAT team members after he allegedly had a physical confrontation with his wife and kidnapped their two-month-old infant several days earlier. Vincent, who was on parole at the time, reportedly ran from police when confronted. The grand jury report states that after taking several steps, Vincent, who was black, began to twist his body, quote, twist his body back around to face Officer Giroux, who had taken a position in the street near the rear of his vehicle with his gun drawn. Vincent then, quote, lowered his body into what appeared to be, and this is the best part, an athletic posture or fighting stance while moving his right arm as if trying to take it or a gun out of his pocket while holding something, end quote. So Giroux then opened fire with an M4 rifle, killing Vincent instantly. The 37-year-old was later found to have been unarmed. Other SWAT team members testified on behalf of Giroux, of course, stating that it had appeared as though Vincent had been drawing a pistol. Giroux also claimed that he believed Vincent was prepared to die in a shootout with police rather than return to prison. The report states that Officer Giroux believed that Mr. Vincent was going to shoot. Officer Giroux testified he thought he was going to be killed. So again, the same, you know, the survivor story always gets the, you know, it's always just destroyed any type of credibility that the police state has when you hear this continuous idea of, and this goes back to the George Zimmerman case, I feel as though my life was in danger. How do you, that's a very subjective and easily defensible or defendable answer. I mean, it's really just scary how many, and now they're opening concealed carry, open carry laws and stuff like that are happening. How many people are going to use that excuse to push the fact that I'm going to kill somebody that I feel is undesirable, which is exactly what's happening now?
Yeah, now I think there's two things there, open carry and the stand your ground laws. And
They're
two separate ones, but I still think there's a very good point here because I think the stand your ground law is what ground. The Zimmerman. Yeah. I mean, you know what really, when I hear, it's just disgusting. It's like every day you hear about another one of these, if you're basically connected on the internet and stuff. One thing, I'm on Facebook with organization called Cop Watch, and they report on these things as they happen across the country and stuff. And of course, the criteria is unarmed civilians being killed by the police, not somebody that actually has a weapon, you know, a firearm. I mean, let's face it. I mean, even if a person had a knife or a machete, I mean, there's ways of that person being disarmed. I mean, shoot them in the leg. You know, why is it they always have to kill somebody, you know, go for headshots, go for, you know, chest shots and stuff. I mean, it's one thing if the person had an actual firearm. It's another when they're, you know, like even if they had a knife or a club, but especially if they're completely unarmed.
Well, you know, athletic position is now the new term to say.
Here's my athletic position. Yeah,
athletic position, that means that you have a weapon now. Just
well,
because
Dave,
you're
I think a lot of this might be coming from down the street.
What do you mean?
There's a major police training institute at the University of Illinois.
Uh-huh.
Don't you think that they might have some influence? You know, in the summer, a lot of times you go to that McDonald's at Kirby and, Neil,
mm-hmm.
and it's full of cops
mm-hmm.
or full of firefighters.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it is. Now, I don't know where these people get their, I don't know the details on that training center, but there must be something going on there. Maybe there's somebody there we could talk to.
You know, that's a good point because I think, you know, two things. One, either they're being trained this way,
this. There's all these common terms, Dave.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody's telling, if they were all saying different things, I wouldn't say that, but they're being trained.
Yeah.
Well, you know,
actually, Sundiata Chajua, who's coming in next week, actually
yes.
worked with the Police Training Institute and did research.
Cool. Oh,
so
okay.
He will definitely be able to give a lot of information about that next week.
Good.
I've had police tell me, like in traffic stops and stuff, that the reason they would do a particular thing or ask me something is, it's my training. You know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and I'm go on.
Yeah, but I mean, I think that it's been for quite some time that these trainers, they're always telling these cops that they are always in danger,
mm-hmm.
you know, that they can't approach any situation without considering that they're going to be killed or, you know, by that person. And, also you're talking about leg shots. You know what they'll say about that? It's too easy to miss.
Mm-hmm.
Then that guy will have seconds and be able to overcome you.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of these things, like with knives, I can't remember there was a term I saw recently in one where somebody was afraid of being attacked by a knife. There's a guy on a sidewalk, and he had a knife, and there was like six police officers around there, and he like moved in one way, and this one cop just emptied a clip on him.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole thing was some kind of concept that had been talked about in police training, and this concept, and I can't remember the name of it, and I'm sorry, but it's the idea of how fast somebody could say leap at you with a knife.
Mm-hmm.
And the person who came up with it says that it's being used completely wrong.
I see.
I'll try and do some research on it.
Well, it'll be interesting what Sundiata has to say next week. I think this is a great lead-in. But anyway, Gus?
Yeah, just to kind of cap off the year, because we spent a lot of time last year talking about this, the official raw numbers of Americans that were killed by police in 2015 is 1,194. Now, these are American citizens.
So, and these people were all unarmed?
Most of them were unarmed.
Okay.
They haven't broken down the data yet.
Okay.
But we don't have the numbers for undocumented people.
Okay.
And also foreigners who were here.
On vacation or whatever.
Yeah, who were on vacation. Yeah. So we don't have those numbers yet. We just have American citizens. 1,194 Americans killed by police. That is a very big increase from last year.
That's more than three a day, if I can do my math correctly.
Yeah, that's right. That's been the number. It's been around. People have been talking about for about a month or so. It's looking like three a day.
Mm-hmm.
And just to match that, there's an article out that's really good, listeners, if you have a chance to read it, called More Police Officers Facing Charges But Few See Jail, that talk about how many of these murders by police lead to actual indictments. So the report actually says that, let me give you the actual numbers. In the prior decade, the yearly average was only 5 indictments per year for police killings. In the state of Florida, as other southern states, no officer has been indicted in over 20 years in the state of Florida. And there's even, that's one of the places that's a hotbed for police killings if you look at the data. And the website to look at a lot of this data for those listening is killedbypolice.net. So if you get a chance to see that and just actually, we get to break down this data. So probably in the next month or so, after the data is broken down, I'm going to do a special story on this. So make sure you tune in for that. But yeah, we gotta really understand where this is coming from and the historical implication, and also what's happening in the future. And I'm going to talk about that at the end of the show, because I think that there's this idea of crisis that the neoliberals are using to push forward the next step in privatized capitalism that I'm going to talk about.
Yes, I was going to mention that too, because besides training, obviously, this is something that the ruling class in this country is, if not tolerating, encouraging. Just by the fact that, what's the Justice Department done? And this is the Obama Justice Department, not the George Bush Department.
Remember, Obama called people who protest police brutality thugs and criminals. The people who had a rebellion in Baltimore. He basically condemned them. And when people are murdered and stuff, he hasn't said anything about the Tamir Rice decision. He hasn't said, only time he has actually said something has been when he had to come out for Trayvon Martin. That was really it. He hasn't been pressured to do anything. And that's why I keep telling people, and this kind of goes into what I'm going to talk about on the sports show today with LeBron James and that whole controversy. We have to stop asking the bourgeoisie to help us in fighting oppression, because they have a stake in oppression. If you understand capitalism and structural oppression, they are not going to help us and fight in our interest. This is a racial class issue, not a racial issue. You have to look at it from a racial class standpoint. Race supplements class, and they are not going to help. So yeah, I mean, that's a very, I mean, like I said, and with the thing with President Obama, he, the only time he's ever even said anything has been to condemn people for protesting police brutality. He hasn't never condemned the police state. He has never talked about racism against black people or brown people by police. He's only said how sad he feels that something has happened. Like I said, my point in this is that you can't depend on the federal government to deal with this. We have to organize ourselves as people, as working people, and educate each other and build movements to change the structure of the country. That's the only way this is going to stop, because it's about to increase based on what we've been seeing the past few months.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Angela?
Well, I was going to say, I believe that, I mean, it's a lot of black African Americans being killed, and mainly they are mostly men. And you know, if you stop the men, if you kill off all the black men, then we can't continue to grow as a black people, you know? So, you know, they're taking all them away, and then they won't be able to make babies if they're not alive, you know what I mean? So it's like they're trying to kill off the black population, period.
Well, you know, it's interesting, you know, because I think you have a good point, Gus, as far as it's a race-class combination. And it's... You gotta wonder, why is it, you know, you look at the numbers. I mean, there's also been, you know, there's been Latino and American Indian, Native American, and, you know, so-called white people, European Americans that have also been killed by the police. But it's black, the African Americans are taking the huge brunt of it. I mean, statistically, as far as the percentage of the population and their numbers, I mean, it's just, wow. I mean,
that's a historical trend, because mm-hmm. police have historically been set upon to go after the poorest people, the most oppressed people, and that was going back when they were first created to be slave catchers. That's what they did. And now that there's been a shift in the political economy, well, not it's shifted again, but the big shift that led to industrial capitalism and the building of cities and urbanization as a process, that's when you saw police that were actually set upon to be surveillance and to be to create a police state in concentrated poverty areas where mostly African Americans and other foreign groups existed.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, and that's where it historically has always happened. Like I said, this is something that is really based in historical precedent and is tied directly to the changing political economy.
But it seems like it's been increasing exponentially here just in the last few years. And I mean, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but it almost seems like the ruling class to push their neoliberal policies basically to push down our living standards are expecting resistance, and they want to promote a policy of fear, you know, basically a fear. Basically, you even question the police and you might be killed.
And that's why I'm telling you, people, please out there, you got to read about this stuff, because David Harvey wrote an amazing book, The Brief History of Neoliberalism, where he lays out, he actually takes the people that Reagan and Thatcher and the other politicians hired to write up neoliberalization process and theory. They actually hired these scholars to write how to introduce and implement neoliberalization. And they actually put it in there that if democracy becomes something that is prominent, you have to repress it, because democracy threatens privatization.
Yes. Go ahead, Angela.
No, but I was going to say, Gus is right though, but with our president, Obama, he's not doing anything like you said, Gus, and I agree with that. He's not, hitting on any issues. He's not saying anything about our people and how they're being treated. So what kind of government and president do we have if he's going along with these shenanigans?
Like I said, you know, and again, people don't like that I use these terms, but I mean, we have to really think of this as, like C.L.R. James said, racial class dynamics. President Obama is a member of the bourgeoisie, plain and simple. He is a ruling elite, and his interests lie in protecting the interests of capitalism and capitalists. And we have to think of it that, and that means, and the police state upholds that type of privatization.
Well, there's also been a thing with Obama where he hasn't wanted to be an quote angry black man, more or less, or have that kind of persona.
You know,
I know that's nothing that the media has really been trying to press on,
well,
but I think
he plays it.
He does play it, but yeah. Obama's background is clearly petty bourgeoisie, right. So. You know, he
doesn't have the experience to do it anyway.
I give you this though. He did do community work before he was as president of the United States.
Yeah.
He was a community organizer. He did work in the Chicago neighborhoods and did community work. But the biggest thing that we have to recognize is that he became a part of an oppressive system. And the only reason that the system allowed him to become president is because he already harbored those types of ideologies of petty bourgeoisie. I want to keep the rich very rich. I want to keep the poor very poor and keep the separate line and increase militarization and police both home and abroad. That's very important. Otherwise, the Democratic Party would have never said, we want you to run for president. He didn't say, I want to run for president. They said, we want you to run for president.
Yeah.
And you got to represent the Democratic Party.
And you got to think about what was going on in 2008. I mean, widespread disgust with the Bush administration and his policies.
Well, I want to go back farther than that.
Well, we're talking about Obama,
I'm talking about Obama.
Uh-huh.
You know how Obama got to be president of the United States? A divorce scandal involving that Ryan who ran against him for Senate. Ryan was a really good candidate, and in downstate Illinois, you know how a lot of people vote here based their thinking. And if Ryan could have won, but he wanted his wife to have public sex with him at sex clubs, somebody, you know, I mean, I can't remember if the records were sealed or not, but somebody got the records out and got that dirt out, and that paved the way for Ryan having to drop out and Alan Keyes run against Obama. And hell, Alan Keyes got 45% of the vote in Pike County, okay? Ryan would have got 80% of Pike in places like Pike County, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, that tells me that there was definitely some that took some connections to be able to get that stuff Dave, publicized.
Remember, you know, some of the things, and I'm getting a little deep state here,
mm-hmm.
but some of the connections of his mother with the State Department, various programs, possible CIA, also even his grandparents.
Well, his grandparents were bankers, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and then his dad was a, you know, notable person in his country. You know, so.
Well, that's interesting too, because his father was actually a recruited student, which was a State
right.
Department program
there
to find,
go.
Anti-left, African students to mm-hmm. groom them, bring them to the United States, pay for their education, all their expenses to try to groom future anti, working class leaders for Africa. I mean, they had like a 10-20 year program here.
I mean, let's I don't want to get too Manchurian.
Yeah.
But let's look at the data though. I mean, like I said, the numbers and the actual facts are actually out there. The Obama administration set the mold for lower living standards through government-backed bankruptcies of General Motors and Chrysler in 2009, during which the wages of new auto workers were cut in half and health care and retirement benefits were decimated. And far from being a racially determined process, vast portions of the industrial working class of every race, gender, and whatever have been subjected to the fate of declining living standards over the last period. Under the terms of the most recent contracts enforced by the UAW and other unions, workers will continue to make wages that do not even allow them to buy the vehicles they produce. And this started primarily under the Obama administration. I mean, stuff happened before that, but the Obama administration is the culmination of a longer historical process during which the Democratic Party has abandoned the programs of social reform with which it had previously been associated when it came to the Great Society, etc. For much of the 20th century, the Democrats advocated certain social programs as a means of containing the class struggle and warding off the dangers of socialism. And again, we have to go back to Roosevelt's New Deal, Harry Truman's Fair Deal, and then, of course, the Great Society.
Under Lyndon Johnson, yeah.
Yeah, so we have to look at this from a historical standpoint at what Obama's doing. He's actually been one of the pieces that has moved the Democratic Party away from helping the masses of people. You know, and again, you can't do that without harboring petty bourgeoisie ideals about holding capitalism as being the best thing to happen for the riches of the rich.
A free market fetish, in other words.
Exactly. Yeah. And like I said, it's really there. If you really get a chance to read this book, it's short and it's to the point, and it's probably one of Harvey's best books, even though he has other ones that are really
good. And what's
good.
The title of the book?
History of Neoliberalism.
A Brief History of Neoliberalism. Okay. Yeah, let's definitely recommend that.
I think I've seen Harvey's name on some articles I've read in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Harvey's good. He's not as good as he was back in the 70s and 80s. But, you know, in terms of his prominence of class struggle and believing in the working class not to be able to organize and to juggernaut to defeat capitalism. But his analysis of the historical processes and the players, I mean, his stuff, another book that's really amazing is called Social Justice in the City.
Mm-hmm.
So he's one of the leading Marxist scholars he's a geographer, but he uses interdisciplinary methodology. So he uses history, geography, sociology to actually look at and understand how capitalism has shifted. He's big on periodization of capitalism and how people have adjusted to fighting it. So he centralizes people. So
okay, there's our caller, and I just want to say real quick, look for the Trans-Pacific Partnership to battle heat up here real soon, and we'll go into that after our caller. Hello, WFT, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Gerald Friedman. I was supposed to call in to talk about health care or something.
Yes, Professor Friedman, thank you. Welcome to the World Labor Hour. Yes, I've been kind of familiar with your work for a while. You did some economic studies about single-payer health care, I mean, both for the nation as well as individual states like Vermont and New York. And what kind of prompted us to want to invite you on the air today is the recent Democratic presidential debate in which Hillary Clinton attacked Bernie Sanders' proposal for a single-payer Medicare for All health care system, in which she used an article from the Wall Street Journal that quoted you and appears extremely distorted your information and whole point of your analysis. So I thought maybe we could start with that if you'd like.
Oh, that's a good place to start. I was very disappointed with Hillary Clinton about that. The Wall Street Journal, I spent a lot of time on the phone with the reporter over the summer, and explaining the numbers and explaining what they mean, that, yes, still, federal government would be spending a lot of money providing health care for everybody, but the total amount that people would be spending on health care would be a lot less when it's done through the federal government, because it could be done so much more efficiently in the Medicare for All system. My original estimate was that the first year we would save, as a country, we would save $600 billion on administrative waste.
$600 billion savings.
$600 billion less would be spent by saving money on administrative waste and overcharging done now by big pharma.
And when you say administrative waste, are you referring to basically the private health insurance industry?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
The private health insurance industry alone has overhead costs, which include profit, marketing, and just paper, excess paper of $200 billion. Right off the bat, we would save almost all that money, because Medicare, the Social Security Administration, is so much more efficient in paying bills. Some of this is just because they're bigger.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, once you set up a system, a computer system to pay bills, if you have a bigger system, it's better. And also, they don't waste all this money on advertising. My health insurance system, I work for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, they're always sending us, you know, unnecessary, brightly colored brochures touting how wonderful they are so that we won't, go off to some other insurance company.
Yes.
And, you know, who needs this? You know, what we want is insurance, and we want it to be comprehensive. And under a single-payer system, we would save so much money, close to $2,000 a person, that we could provide coverage for everybody, which even under the Affordable Care Act is not happening. And we could provide it without co-pays and deductibles, so people wouldn't have to, you know, spend all this time worrying about, well, is it worth going to the doctor for this? You know, should I go to the doctor for that? And thousands of Americans die every year because they delay seeing a doctor because of the cost of going. We
yes.
could do away with all that, and we would still save hundreds of billions of dollars.
Yes, and I think also, from what I understand from your studies, is besides 90-some percent of the general public out there saving thousands of dollars a year per person, it would also reduce the budget deficits of national, state, local government, as well as school districts, because there wouldn't be the all the health care expense. Is that correct?
That's right. That's right. What goes on now actually is the public sector is subsidizing the private sector, because the public sector generally provides decent health insurance to public sector workers, including family coverage. An increasing share of private sector employers don't provide family coverage, but they make it very expensive.
Hmm.
So coupled where one partner is working in the public sector, they get the coverage through the public sector. Through the public sector worker. Well, the private sector worker doesn't pick up any health insurance through work. So the private sector is the worker is his or her health insurance is being covered by the public sector. And then people go around and say public sector workers are overpaid because look at all the money that's being spent on health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a big chunk of it is being paid to cover the health insurance needs of private sector workers. Making private sector workers less expensive. Now, you know, that may be fine, but why don't we just cover everybody? And then we don't have to worry about all this cost shifting. And it would be a huge boon for the average, I don't know Illinois, but Massachusetts, about a quarter of the payroll of public sector, of school districts and public sector in general, is health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
That would mean lower taxes and better services, better roads, better education, better conservation services, better policing, because the public sector won't be carrying this burden. And American private sector businesses would also be saving. Now, the study that I talked about with the Wall Street Journal is actually outdated. And since then, the Sanders campaign. I should say as a disclaimer, I am not paid by them. I'm not part of the campaign, but it happened that I did an analysis of how much his program would cost, just as a thing that I thought would be interesting to do. And the $15 trillion figure that Hillary was citing, which was actually $14.6 trillion, that everything just rounds up.
Yeah.
That number is no longer correct. It's more like $13 trillion. That sounds like a big difference, but actually it's, when I did the original estimate 4 years ago, the projections for health care were higher than rising health care costs were higher than they are now. Partly this is just because of slower rate of inflation for the economy as a whole. Anyway, so you're under $13 trillion. And that actually allows a big difference in the financing. Taking $1.5 trillion off the cost, you can lower the payroll cost. So the Sanders plan right now would involve a payroll premium charge of only 4.5%, which is lower than what I've been talking about before. The average private sector employer now has a payroll cost for health insurance of over 12%. So that employer, that private business, will be saving over 7% of the cost of doing business, of the cost of hiring workers.
Mm-hmm.
Hire more workers, they'll be able to produce and sell in export markets that are now closed to American business because of the cost of doing business, of health insurance. Americans will be exporting business, they'll be getting new jobs. You know, the savings for American workers will be enormous.
Oh, by the way, too, also those small businesses you're talking about, it relieves them the burden of dealing with any health insurance.
Oh, God, that is a psychic as well as financial burden for small business. When I say that, you know, that 12% figure that the average American business, that's 12% on average. For the small businesses, it could be, you know, on average, 14-15% payroll cost. And on top of that, you have to add the cost of consultants and, you know, that are hired to negotiate with the health insurance industry. And then, you know, the fear factor, the psychic weight. I know several small business people, and every year when they come around to, you know, getting the renewal, they worry, is it going to be 15%? Is it going to be 20%? Maybe I'll get off with just 2% increase in my health insurance cost. But it's much more variable than for big business because you have a smaller pool. If you've got only 10 workers and one of them gets sick, then suddenly you get a big jump in cost. And what do? You fire that worker? Technically illegal. You certainly have to think about when you're hiring somebody, you look at them. How likely are they to get sick?
Oh, I just had an idea too. We also have these worker compensation systems.
Yeah.
And, you know, you would still have to, you know, of course take care of your employees' income, but, then they would be relieved of, the health care, right?
That's right. About half the cost of workers' comp is, medical. And it's more than that because there are also, you know, administrative and legal expenses tangled up with when a worker gets sick when a worker gets hurt on a job. You know, deciding whether is this a disability claim or is this a workers' comp claim. You know, sometimes litigation involved, which is makes life very difficult for somebody who's hurt or sick, and is taxing on the employer. You know, basically we have a system that has lots and lots of private taxes built into financing health care. You know, you may think, oh, I'm hiring a health insurance company. That's a private activity, nothing like a tax. Well, wait a second. If you have to have health insurance, which is mandated under the Affordable Care Act, and has been accepted as an obligation by virtually all, at least medium and large businesses, even before that, then what Cigna or United Healthcare or whatever is doing is they're basically imposing a tax on you. It's a private tax. but it's just as burdensome. A dollar paid to them is just as bad for business as a dollar paid to the U.S. government. Except it's not a to get the same service, it's not a dollar paid to the private insurance. It's a dollar 25 because private health insurance is a lot less efficient than public health insurance. If we had had everybody on Medicare starting in 1971 and Medicare costs had gone up the way they have, we would be spending $1.5 trillion less on health care than we do now. All of the, our health care costs in this country have doubled because of excess cost inflation that is all in the private health insurance system.
Yeah, it's funny. I was talking to a person on the phone at a hospital, an accounts person there, a person who's running their finances, and he blames Medicare for the healthcare inflation. He did. He told me that he goes Medicare, and I said, "Hey, wait a minute. I remember when that was passed."
No, he's completely wrong.
But that's probably what he was taught in college,
or taught by the administration, or the training at the yes.
Oh, I'm sure that there are costs associated with processing Medicare bills, but they're a fraction of the cost of processing private insurance bills. And if everybody was on Medicare, then you would have just one set of codes, one set of forms. It would be vastly easier to process. I mean, you look across the border. Toronto General Hospital has about the same number of patients and doctors as Massachusetts General Hospital. Massachusetts General Hospital is the Harvard teaching hospital. Toronto General, Massachusetts General, same patient load. Massachusetts General last year had 453 people doing billing. Toronto General had four.
453 people at Massachusetts General and four at Toronto General Hospital to do in billing. That's incredible.
Well, I see ads all the time, looking for people to do that like on a freelance basis.
Yeah, they do that. Some people do it at home because, you're connected by computer. In some ways, it doesn't matter where you are. There are a large number of people who do this, and built into the various single-payer proposals on the federal level and in some states is extended unemployment insurance and retraining for these workers. But these are mostly bad jobs. I mean, Steve Helmsley, the head of United Healthcare, he took home, I think $54
million. $54 million, United Healthcare CEO.
The average person doing billing, in some places it's a minimum wage job. In other places it's more than minimum, but it's not very good.
Yes.
And there's a high turnover in these jobs. I mean, we could find useful things for people to do, including providing more health care.
And also, if you think about it, if there was when a single-payer system happens, I'm going to say when, not if, in the United States, I just hope it's in my lifetime. But anyway, the transition from basically greatly reducing the private health insurance industry down to where they're only providing like cosmetic surgery policies or luxury policies where people get a private room, kind of like what exists in Germany, where my wife's from originally. You've got all these employees. A lot of people are saying, well, it would displace all these workers in the private health insurance industry. But if you think about it, wouldn't all those workers currently in the private health insurance industry, for instance, doing billing, making maybe a little bit above minimum wage, would then be actual public employees represented by a union and making a good, decent wage, plus having a good retirement pension and, of course, free health care, or I should say affordable health care, because it'd be based on ability to pay for everybody.
Yeah. Well, some of them would be employed by the Medicare for All system. But there would be a lot of displacement because the Medicare for All system would be much more efficient and it wouldn't need most of these people. But as I said, there'd be job retraining, and many of them would immediately slide over to be doing medical tech work.
Mm-hmm.
We'd have something on the order of a 10% increase in demand for healthcare. The people who are currently uninsured would start getting more health care. And as I said, people who currently don't go to the doctor because of the cost of co-pays and deductibles would start going to the doctor more often. Eventually, we'd get a benefit on the other side because people would be healthier.
Yes.
But during the transition, there'd be a bump up in demand for medical services. And many of the people currently doing billing would be natural ones to just walk across the hall, get retrained, and go to work as phlebotomists, nurses' aides, and eventually moving up.
Sure.
And I have would be a lot better job.
Sure. And we're starting to run out of time here, and I have a question from a listener that wanted to know. The question is, can we assume that if the U.S. or a state, individual state for that matter, adopted a single-payer system after a transition period, our per capita cost for health care would fall in line with those of other industrialized countries? If not, why?
I think it's reasonable to assume that. I think that there's nothing in the United States that makes that should make us pay twice as much for health care as everybody else. In 1971, the United States and Canada, for example, were spending about the same amount per person on health care as a share of gross domestic product. But since then, our costs have risen a lot faster. Well, they've had a single-payer system, and now we pay twice as much. We spend twice as much. I don't see what's greatly different about us versus people in Ontario.
Mm-hmm.
We do tend to be healthier. It's a myth that Americans are unhealthy in our behavior. We do eat too much. You know, we are a bit fatter than other people. And we do shoot each other more, which is unfortunate. But the major killers, the major lifestyle killers in the world are smoking and cars. We are safe drivers. We're among the safest drivers in the world. And we smoke about half as much as do people in Europe. And we even smoke less than Canadians. So we also drink less. I'm not sure whether that's a good thing or not.
Okay.
Yeah, so there's no reason why we should be spending so much on health care.
Yes.
And getting such bad outcomes. We have shorter life expectancy than Canadians, I mean,
And Western Europeans, too, I imagine.
And Western Europeans.
Yeah. So just to sum up real quick, basically, a single-payer Medicare health care system for either an individual state or an entire country would result in a total freedom of choose who your doctor or clinic or hospital you would go to. It would cover everybody. Nobody would be left out. It'd be paid for fairly, basically based on your income ability to pay. There'd be less administrative cost. In other words, it'd be cheaper to administer because you would be cutting out the private healthcare industry, and instead having, Medicare public sector workers do it. It'd be job friendly in the sense that the savings for not just individuals federal, state, city governments and school districts, but also for small, medium, and large businesses would result in a cost savings to taxpayers, which could result in lower taxes, even lower property taxes, but also would spur businesses' ability to grow as far as hire more people. And last but not least, it'd be the most affordable, that basically it would bring our health care costs, which currently are twice double what any other industrialized country has, down to probably at least close to where the other industrialized countries is, saving us, trillions of dollars a year.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, I just had to do that sum up here real quick because we threw a lot of information around there. But, that's interesting that Hillary Clinton, who supposedly tried so hard to pass a health care bill back in the early mid-90s, is attacking Bernie. It seems like she really, got vicious on this whole with the thing with single payer, which, I thought that was interesting in and of itself.
Yeah, well, I think she's a politician. She wanted to distance herself from the left, show she's more moderate, and she's looking at the general election.
And not to mention the healthcare industry campaign contributions.
That too.
Yes, indeed. Well, Professor Friedman, thank you so much for calling in. And, you know, I think as time goes on here, you're going to become more and more prominent in the public spotlight because, you know, the single-payer moving, even though there's almost a total media blackout on the movement that's going on across the country, it is growing. It can't be ignored for too much longer. And I think, you know, your excellent study on this is going to become more and more, you know, common knowledge. You're soon to be a household name, I think.
God forbid.
Okay. Well,
I hope movement becomes a household name for sure.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for calling in. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
That has no clue what's inside fighting between the red and the blue. Political corruption, sex scandals out of control. The people are tired of care. Wage and captive for the people want to change. Tired of the same old thing. They can't wait for the polls to open. Down with the status quo. Country going through recession, jobs are on the line. Kids can't afford college, the bills are so far behind. Sheep's got a headlock on us, gas is on the rise. Can't afford to use my dollar. It's like the people want to change. Tired of the same old thing. They can't wait for the polls to open. Down with the status. To be rented, bury me like a mummy when I die. The people want to change. Tired of the same old thing. They can't wait for the cold to open. Down with the status quo. Immigration, hate crimes, and discrimination. Global warming, genocide, default, and very alarming. Illegal occupation of a nation by a failed administration. Economic crisis, crooked lending devices. Tax cuts for the rich.
Okay, you're listening to the World Labor Hour on WFT, listener supported community radio station in Champaign, Illinois, broadcast at 90.1 FM and at WEFT.org on the internet live worldwide. Okay, so we're back and, got a little time left here. Gus, you're yeah. saving something to wrap up here.
Yeah, I think that we really need to be very critical of 2015 and also look forward to what's going on in 2016. So there's some really good pieces online about where we're headed and where we're going. And one of the pieces I read was from a guy named Gideon Rockman, who wrote a very good piece about what the word crisis has come to mean and how it becomes an action by the neoliberals to continue to fracture any type of democratic movement. So he writes that crises appear not as isolated episodes anymore in a neoliberal global economy. They're not isolated anymore, but they're more or less permanent features of contemporary reality. So the pattern of perpetual crisis that characterized not only 2014 has became a staple of 2015, and they see it extending into 2016. So what you see happening is that the ruling class seeks to cover over the reality of capitalism beneath a mass of lies, hypocrisy, and mass hysteria. War is cloaked in the language of freedom and democracy. Antisocial domestic policy is portrayed as the pursuit of equality and freedom, but, and this is a characteristic of a period of crisis, more and more the essential nature of capitalism, a system designed solely for exploitation, inequality, war, and repression, comes into alignment with the everyday experiences of broad masses of people. So illusions are dispelled, the essence appears. So in the sphere of world economy, any expectation of an upturn has given way to the reality of permanent crisis. That is key, y'all. Any expectation of an upturn has given way to the reality of a permanent crisis. In the United States, we are now 6 years within the so-called recovery of since the Great Recession. Real unemployment remains at near record highs. Wages are under attack and stagnant, and health care and pensions for millions of Americans are being wiped out across the country. Now, again, I'm not being doom and gloom here, but this is political education so that we can understand our social condition so that we can form organizing strategies amongst ourselves. So I'm not a doom and gloom person, but I'm letting you know that we need to understand our condition. Europe is growing at less than 2% a year, and large parts of the European economy, including Greece, the target of brutal austerity measures that we talked about on this show for many times, they are in deep recession right now. China, presented as a possible engine of world economic growth, is slowing sharply. Brazil and much of Latin America are in a deep slump, and Russia has just entered a recession. So meanwhile, the easy money policies of the world's central banks has produced a new wave of the worst thing you can ever see, speculative investment, centered on junk bonds and other forms of debt, which is beginning to unravel. And for those that don't know, speculation is something that they've been doing for centuries now, that is a more exploitation and abuse of working people, buying up things very cheaply and then unloading them for making a profit off of it.
So the essential, as opposed to actually producing something.
Exactly.
Yes.
So the essential and intended consequence of government policy over the past 7 years under the Obama administration has been to vastly increase social inequality. During the past year, the wealth of the world's billionaires surged past $7 trillion. Wow. Let me say that again for those listening. During the past year, 1 year, the wealth of the world's billionaires surged past $7 trillion, and the top 1% now control half of the world's wealth.
1% controls half the world's wealth.
Half of the world's wealth. In the U.S., the scale of social inequality, also known as political inequality, which we'll talk about with Sundiata next week, is so great that one recent scientific study concluded that the preferences of the vast majority of Americans appear to have essentially no impact on which policies the government does or doesn't adopt. And to end out, what I'm saying is the economic crisis intersects with and intensifies geopolitical conflicts, which in 2015 brought the globe closer to world war than at any other time in the past half century. Virtually every part of the world has either become a battlefield or is assuming the character of a potential battlefield, hence crisis. So again, the neoliberals and the government are pushing crisis politics and crisis action on the ground using war, using imperialism in other countries, and using police repression and the stagnation of wages against working people in this country to further neoliberalization.
So rich people can get richer,
exactly.
Basically.
Exactly. I mean, we've seen it here, and it's worked. It's at the point now where $7 trillion now belongs in the hands of 1% of the world's wealthiest people. This is not conspiracy theory. This stuff is actually printed in the Wall Street Journal. It's printed in news articles that actually have real data. So this is not a conspiracy. We have the means to stop this from getting worse if we continue to educate ourselves about our condition and create organizing methods on the ground ground to challenge this structure of oppression.
Oh yeah, I agree with that. It's time for another movement, isn't it? Another civil rights movement. We need to all get together. But like you said, Gus, we all need to come together because we can want something and come together for it. But if everybody who's affected by it doesn't come together with us, then it's not going to do any good.
And that's always the biggest conflict in terms of organizing is internal. Different ideologies, you know, again, trying to organize. That's why I say one of the biggest critical pieces is that we have to understand what type of world do we want. We have to reimagine something different. And that's a problem for bourgeoisie and petty bourgeoisie people. As, you know, because they don't experience the same level of oppression that working and poor people feel or experience. So again, that's that goes into education, mm-hmm. you know, but then again, there's even a deeper question of can you organize with petty bourgeoisie and bourgeoisie if you're working class or lower? Can you really do it? And I argue that you can't, but that's a whole other story. But again, the thing is that we have to, the key thing is education. This type of show, WEFT, other stations, other forms of media that's alternative that talk about the stories of the people, we have to start promoting these like crazy. And I'm not talking about every Saturday. I'm talking about every day. We need to be talking about the World Labor Hour. We need to be talking about La Carta Nuestra, the new alternative newspaper at the University of Illinois, Public Eye. We need to start promoting these things all over the country because that's how we're going to start educating the masses to organize themselves and not rely on asking the president or asking the police or asking other forms of oppression to help us. It's never going to happen. It has never happened. We have to change our strategy.
Indeed, indeed. And we have to, you know what the problem is and who's causing it before we can effectively, you know, organize and focus on, you know, what to do. And then those people that are, you know, you referred to them as petty bourgeois and bourgeois, basically the middle class, upper middle class, you know, how many people have slipped from being middle class into the ranks of poverty over the last 10, you know, years in particular? That's one thing those people need to consider. The other thing is, even if they are comfortable and getting by, you know, comfortably, what about the whole threat to democracy when you have such a small number of people controlling that much wealth?
Exactly.
You know, because then they can buy basically elections and they can control the elected officials.
That's one reason you will hear from a lot of Republicans now that the United States is not a democracy, it's a republic. But let's see, the thing is, you know what I tell them?
What?
I tell them that, well, it's a republic that operates through democratic processes. And the next time it comes up, I don't know why I never thought of this before, I'm going to say, how else would you like to make decisions? Who do you want to be the dictator?
Yeah. Well, that's the thing is, I don't think we're even a republic anymore. I think we're really a plutocracy, an oligarchy.
Well, it's an empire. Yeah. We've gone, an oligarchy. You know, it's always been an empire, too. It started that way.
Yeah, okay. That could be a topic of the whole show, for sure.
Okay, and at least since the Mexican-American War of 1849, if that was an
No, but definitely, I agree. I would argue that we've always had imperial ideology, not we, but the United States government, or even before that, the British colonies, mm-hmm. in regards to mercantile capitalism. I mean, that's what the American mm-hmm. Revolution, how it really just got started with the bourgeoisie here in America. They were upset that they were not making the same type of profits anymore. They weren't getting their cut.
Because of a corporate monopoly.
Exactly. They already had the West Indian Tea Company. They had those ideologies already. So they had petty bourgeoisie ideology already. So again, that goes into what Bill was just saying, that they already had that mentality that we're going to be an empire, we're going to compete, we're going to be better, we're going to exploit, of course, with slavery. Mm-hmm. So again, like I said, that's always been here. That's always been in this land.
So it's time for us to evolve, basically, because frankly, the survival of the planet depends on it, right, Bill?
Yeah. Yes, it does.
among other things. So, listen, we've went a little bit over, but thank you so much for tuning in today. You've been listening to the World Labor Hour on listener-supported community radio station WFT in Champaign, Illinois. And tune in next week for Professor Sundi Adejajua, who will be on the program. He's what is his official title? Is he Professor of African-American Studies?
Associate Professor of African-American Studies and History at
okay.
the University of Illinois.
Yes, and he'll be on the program. It will be an excellent program. So tune in for that. And until then, be safe and power to the people. Take care.